The Guardian.
Football Weekly with James Richardson.
Football Weekly, today's special England-Spain commemorative podcast. Juan Carlos Pedro Almodóvar, last catch-up. Your boys took not very much of a beating. The pod applauds Capello's England and their Marxist disinterest in possession. Here's sour grapes from sore Spain and then moves on to proper action, Euro playoffs, and some interesting views from our position in between the two legs. Ireland's 4-0 win in Estonia, ensuring pussies in the bag for Keane and co, while it turns out Turkish fans would say boo to a goose after their team's collapse to Croatia. There's all the international news and views ahead of the next round of matches, plus tweets, posts and more in Football Weekly. Well, hello, international football fan. Glad you could join us. What a lineup we have today on Football Weekly. Boy band good looks. Woof. Paul McInnes.
Do you reckon?
Yeah, I think so.
I'm shaving years off with every passing day.
No, I think you're the slightly maturer one.
Oh.
Yeah. But bringing the knowledge and wisdom and gentleness of touch that an older man offers. Greg Ruffley.
Hi, James.
Sorry, ladies, he's taken.
I've got glasses on today.
Yeah.
Too intelligent.
Don't tell me about it. And Raphael Honigstein.
Hello.
Hi, Raphael. Yes,
what?
Smoothie. Anyway, sorry, right. On with the football. Quickly. England, Paul, Greg, what do you think about this? 71% of possession for the Spanish. 21 attempts on goal for the Spanish against 3 for England. Would you rather lose than win that way, as one Spanish columnist put it? Or should we celebrate this as a tactical triumph and get used to being the new Greece?
I think celebrate the tactical triumph. I don't celebrate it too wildly.
No?
But it was a reasonably convincing performance from England. They were robust throughout the match, apart from that one time when Fabregas got the wrong side of the defence.
I've got that word robust written down in
Boom.
Front of me as well.
Oh, right, excellent.
I mean, I don't think you can celebrate it as a triumph. I think it was like watching Switzerland versus Spain in the World Cup.
I bet the Swiss celebrated that.
Well, no, they did celebrate it. I mean, it's no surprise that England would play this way against Spain, because Spain, they play a style of football which is like seven-a-side football. They squeeze the pitch, and so there's impossible areas to work in. And they're the best. They've got the technically superior players who can do that, and that's why they're successful. But for England, I mean, they're not going to win that game. They're not going to win seven-a-side football against Spain. So the only way they could play was to play on the counter-attack, to give up possession too easily. I mean, at times, it wasn't just that they were trying to play speculative balls. They were inferior in some ways. The passing wasn't as good as, you know, anywhere near as good as it should have been. But then they grew in confidence in the second half after the goal. And I think they basically won because there's two things that Spain maybe are, two areas where they are weak, in that they maybe haven't got as much pace as England had, and also they're not as physically strong in the air, which is why Lampard's free kick was, you know, it was a very well taken free kick. It had to be, because it was the only way that England were going to win the game off a set piece.
P. Daddy sides with you on that. He says it wasn't a classic, but it was only a friendly, but a win's a win. Capello must feel damned if he does and damned if he doesn't, because that was the tactical approach to take. Jupe17 though says, I heard the commentators gushing about the back four. I've seen the game twice and only left Scott looks solid. There were two marginally wrong offside decisions in the first half. Both times, Jagielka and Johnson were out of position. Blah, 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 blah. More stuff there. So not quite as rosy. Well, one or two interesting views from the Spanish, as you may have read, this game. Let's hear now from Sid Lowe, who joins us from Spain. Sid.
Hello, James.
Hi, Sid. Did you enjoy the game?
I'm not sure enjoy is quite the right word. I found it interesting in its own way. But it was disappointing in terms of the lack of pace, the lack of speed of it. Spain's friendly team turned up, I think is probably the best way of putting it.
All right. For the same reason that there are albinos in Africa, snakes with two heads and Japanese over 2 metres tall, England beat Spain at Wembley, wrote Luis Nieto in the opening paragraph of ASS's match report. Wise words, Sid.
Yeah, his point being that this was a one-off, a freak of nature, something that really shouldn't have happened, that Spain had completely dominated. I think it's probably worth adding that the Spanish haven't been entirely uncritical of the way they played. There's a recognition that they were kind of leaden-footed at times, that they didn't move the ball with anything like the speed that they normally do. They created very, very few problems for England until probably the last 15 minutes, when I thought they were reasonably good. But they still can't quite understand, for the most part, how on earth England managed to win that game. Yeah, draw 0-0 perhaps, but winning it is which I think for most Spain is a step too far.
Mm. If Spain won their games like this, I convert to curling rather than puff my chest out and be proud of a footballing infamy like that, says Thomas Roncero, who you're a big fan of.
To be fair, it's probably worth adding here that Thomas Roncero is completely bonkers.
Yeah.
His byline picture, sorry to interrupt, I shouldn't stop your wonderful flow, James, but his byline picture shows him with a Spain flag between his teeth, Spain flags painted on his cheeks, and doing the victory salute a la Winston Churchill. So I think that tells you something.
All right. I wish him luck with his new love, curling. But anyway, here's my point, Sid. You say there is a little bit of concern, though, among the Spanish press, because I remember you used to tell us about how many games Spain had gone unbeaten. But now, they may only be friendlies, but they're losing all over the shop. Argentina, Portugal, Italy, the Swiss game that we've just been mentioning, and now even England. Is this not a sign that teams are actually getting wise on as to how to stop the Spanish?
That's certainly one way of looking at it. And I think you remember talking on Thursday, and Barry was saying, you know, is it worth betting on England? Well, yeah, it definitely is in friendlies, because Spain have been absolutely hammered by both Argentina and Portugal. They were beaten as well by Italy, and you know, their friendly performance have been poor. I think it does show that to some extent some teams are working out a way of playing against Spain, but that's not particularly clever. Anyone can work out to, and you know, I don't necessarily mean this as a criticism, but it's not particularly clever to work out to park the bus, to be extremely defensive, to try and plan the break and hope that it comes off, because that kind of approach often is based on protection and hope rather than any proactive approach. So that's not hugely surprising. It's not particularly earth-shattering. It also shows, and I know that Raf mentioned this the other day, I think he's quite right, that Spain without intensity, the tiki-taka approach, without intensity and a little bit of ability to vary the game and play aggressively in terms of going for teams, it's really not the same. And I do think that if you talk to Spain's players privately about the way they feel about the friendlies, in particular about the way that the Spanish Football Federation has set them up. For example, they're now in Costa Rica, and it's absolutely the last thing that Spanish players want. I think that helps to explain the difference in attitude as well. Certainly, Spain will continue to look for variations. I think that's why Jesús Navas is back in the squad, why you've got people like Llorente there as well, so that they can play another way. But I think we'd be wrong if we saw playing another way as, right, let's ditch this and play something completely different. No, I think it's more a case of small variations within a basic philosophy.
Sid, I'm going to Raphael Honigstein.
I wanted to ask you about the Costa Rica game, but in the wider context, because it seemed to me, from seeing Spain in Wembley, that they weren't really all that bothered. So can we see these performances and the way that Iker Casillas, for example, refused to talk about his record-breaking cap and said, I'm concentrating on the Costa Rica game right now, that's all I want to think about, and it was clearly being said in a sarcastic manner. Should we see this as a kind of some silent protest against what the FA are doing to them, sending them all over the world like the Harlem Globetrotters?
It's a good question. I don't think you can see it as a protest in terms of the defeat of the protest, and I don't think it's as systematic or as deliberate as that. But there is definitely a feeling within, I would say, the entire squad, but obviously I can't speak for every single player in it, but a feeling amongst a lot of the players that it's absolutely laughable that since the World Cup the Federation has gone, oh, this is good. We can, as you rightly say, it's Harlem Globetrotters. We can parade the world champions around the world. It doesn't matter where we take them. We can keep on doing it. The Spanish national team, for example, turned up on Thursday, and you know, obviously you know this because I was talking to you on the pod about it, turned up on Thursday. They trained for about 45 minutes, 50 minutes in the evening, and they basically turned up in Madrid in order to film an advert and in order to do a couple of events. Now, the event was a very nice one. It was a UEFA one designed to honour the players who got to 100 caps. But the Spanish players do feel that they turn up at the squad. They're there to kind of, you know, fulfil the promises that the Spanish president has made to other federations within Spain and other federations internationally, and there to help the federation make money, and not necessarily there to help plan in the best possible way for the future.
Let's talk more about England. What do you want to do? Good points? Do you want Rob Mauger's point that possibly this lucky good defensive display could be in part put down to the absence of John Terry? Is that something you want to discuss?
That is certainly something I want to discuss. I would also like to excise any use of the word lucky. I don't think England were lucky. I think they play well. And I think what Sid was saying about any team can work out to park the bus, yeah, fair enough, you can arrange yourself in that way. But actually, I think you need to have a degree of technical ability in order, especially defensively, in order to be able to interrupt those moves. And that's what England did very well in the centre of the pitch.
Do you not think, though, say England played that way against Spain over five games, I mean, the cream would rise to the top and Spain would win that series of games, which would mean they're a better tournament team. So
probably, yeah.
I mean, there is an element of luck when you're so defensive that you need maybe, you know, the ball to hit the post as Villa did, and, you know, for things not to go well, for Fabregas not to have a shooting boot on.
England could also have played a lot better with the ball. I think that they didn't show the confidence, like you said, until the second half, particularly they're trying to play those little triangles out from the back through Parker, through Jones. It wasn't until the second half that they actually had a little bit more confidence to switch the play, to make those quick 20-yard passes. And that, I think that would also kind of play out over a long run of games. But the point I wanted to make about the Terry thing is that what you really saw was a very organised team performance where people stuck to a plan. And that isn't something you can often say about England. And I do think that will be more likely to happen when you don't have the big names in the side.
No, there are many, many things to talk about. I think Capello was probably the happiest he ever was in the England job, because for the reason that Rob said, that he did feel, Paul said, that he did feel that for once the team actually stuck to a plan, which is not something that you can say very often about an England team, full stop. Having said that, there is very little of actual football being played in the white shirts.
They were without their most talented player.
Yeah, absolutely.
And apart from John Terry, also Wayne Rooney was out as well. No?
they made the most of it. And of course, this goes back to Spain's weaknesses and their problems when they don't quite have the people on the flanks to go past players. That they don't have a Messi, or they don't have a Villa in good form, or they don't have a Torres in good form. If you just condense the field as much as England do, it's very, very difficult, even by passing, because there is nowhere to go. The passing can only take you till the back four, and then you're offside. So they did that very well.
It's a bit like what Sir Francis Drake did, basically, back in the Armada. No? He sat off the coast and basically let the Armada come onto him, and then
big galleons onto the pitch.
But I do still feel that it does raise questions, because how many games can England really realistically put themselves into this underdog, back to the wall, we're fighting the Huns kind of spirit?
That's the question, isn't it? But yeah. I think it's partly about that mental attitude, and that is the longest running question about the England team. But it is also about people being willing to adapt to a system. And you can play different systems, we can have different tactical approaches, which will be more effective when we are the favourites, but people need to subscribe to them.
It'll be interesting to see how England do against Sweden then, because I mean the expectancy is completely turned around there, where England are expected to be the attacking team, to maybe play some football, and that's where we'll see whether they can actually do it. And against Spain, I think they were pressed back to such an extent that they found that rigidity, like the rigid kind of formation themselves, and they had to play a defensive style because they had no other option. Whereas against Sweden, they'll be expected to come out and go at them.
So. Sweden, who last week just lost 2-0 to Denmark in a friendly, a one-man team, as Marcus Christensen described them, who are better without their one man. Zlatan Ibrahimovic being the player in question. A lot of talk that England are going to be going with a 4-3-3. Against Sweden. Are you happy about that? Sturridge, Zamora and Andy Johnson.
I think that's interesting, and I think that there's lots of pace there, there's ability. I think another thing I thought about the game was, and people have said that Capello might have gone over the top a little bit in his praise for the younger players, but I do think that most of the players who are coming through the England under-21s into the national team are technical players. They may be not as technical as the Spanish, but they are a lot more technical than, I have to say, Stuart Downing. He was terrible on Saturday, and his touch was bouncing all over the place. But yeah, I always feel the same with Gareth Barry. I think this new generation that's coming through can play technical football at the highest level, and I think giving them the opportunity now is the right thing to do.
Mm. I mean, interesting to see against Sweden.
It is a bit strange how Capello has performed a 180-degree flip from saying, I have no players, what I'm going to do against the world champions, to these young kids are just fantastic, they're brilliant, they're the future of English football. I think the kids are all right, but I'm not sure all right will cut it at this level.
Oh,
Yeah, I'm not as sure about as Paul is about the technical ability of England's players. I just think it's kind of ingrained within them that you've got to be more physical, and tackling is more important, because if you want to be at the highest level in the Premier League, you do have to have that physical element to your game.
If you look at the two most physical players in that young group, Phil Jones and Jack Rodwell, they are technically adept players.
Oh, there's a moment though where Phil Jones had the ball and he was coming forward with it, and had it been a different player, had it been Wayne Rooney, for instance, you get the impression that it would have been a more incisive pass, or he would have done something more than what he did, which was play the more simple ball out to his left rather than try and play the ball through the middle.
It's I don't think there's a coincidence that England looked happiest without the ball in that game.
No, but I appreciate that, and they didn't. Spain looked much more comfortable in the ball, but we are talking about playing against Spain, and the people who not only are very effective with the ball, but because they have so much of the ball, have a large degree of energy to expend when they don't, and they close down very effectively. England were put under a lot of pressure in that midfield area, and they struggled at times. Other times, they were reasonably effective, but that is one of the toughest situations that midfield three will be put in, I think.
All right, then. Well, looking forward to the Sweden game. Should just mention, as we round off part one, England not the unofficial world champions. A lot of people say, we've beaten the world champions. Does that make us unofficial world champions? No. Because as the website Unofficial World Champions reveals, the current number ones are, anybody know?
Japan.
Japan, Raphael Honigstein, of course you know. But they beat Argentina 1-0 last October. Are the Argentines having previously beaten official champions Spain? Japan have now gone 16 games unbeaten as the unofficial world champions. And retain the title for more than 12 months. Get there, mate. Anyway, that's enough for part one. Very, very shortly, we'll be getting all the drama of Ireland's 4-0 win over Estonia. Well, joined by a special guest now in part two, authentic Irishman Evan Fanning, fresh from Ireland's terrific 4-0 victory over Estonia. And first off, Evan, the cat very much in the sack now.
The cat is definitely in the sack, I think, despite Trapattoni warning that it's a wild cat and could escape from the sack. You would have to think that it's going to stay in the sack.
And I'm wondering, did he mean Estonia are a wild card and he just got the word wrong with cat? Because some people are suggesting that that's where this expression comes from.
Oh.
It's his buzz phrase in Italy, and has been for a long time. But we were talking about it last week and wondering why cats were in sacks anyway. I'll just bring this up. A couple of people posting, and thanks so much for this. Gio Pizzo says, sorry guys, your attempted explanation is don't say cat if it's not in the sack are redundant, because the actual Italian proverb is non dire quattro se non ce l'hai nel sacco. So quattro, non gatto. And basically, this is from a story of some men who were trying to put four birds in a sack, and one flew away. They said four. Terrific stuff. Yeah, very folkloristic, this. But apparently Trapattoni just got the word wrong, and it's become his catchphrase ever since. However, other people are posting and saying, no, cats in bags, that was a trick whereby a yokel would pay money to buy a piglet at a fair, and the merchant would slip a cat into a bag and give it to the unsuspecting buyer, who would not discover that he had been robbed until he got home, and here's another phrase, and let the cat out of the bag. Hey, how about that, eh? Anyway, sorry, Ireland beat Estonia the other day.
Ireland beat Estonia 4-0, and you would have to think, although they're pretty much in the European Championships now, although if any team is capable of throwing away a four-goal lead, you
really
would think it could well be Ireland. But it was a strange game. Estonia must be one of the worst teams ever to make a playoff. They were abysmal. Ireland were pretty a little bit better. First half was quite even. Estonia had a man sent off 10 minutes before half time, and then another man sent off in the second half. So it was 9 men Estonia, which 11 men Estonia weren't up to much. So
so you think it's that rather than necessarily a great change of style or a coming of age?
Well, no. I mean, I think the team has progressed quite a lot. I mean, in the two campaigns under Trapattoni, they've got better and better. They've they're playing to his kind of way. They've 6 clean sheets in this campaign, if you include Friday, 9 clean sheets in 10 matches including friendlies. And the second half was great because it was there to win at halftime to put the tie to bed. They were 1-0 up and they went out and got 3 more goals, and it was quite ruthless. It was determined, but in Trapattoni's very pragmatic way, they took very little risks and did the job. And it's he's had a fair bit of stick, or people are undecided about him, but at the end kind of justifies the means, and they look to be there.
Is it benefiting Ireland having such a stubborn manager? Do you think the fact that he's not going to be swayed by public opinion and he's got his own ideas about who he wants to select? And
I mean, you wonder, does he even know what public opinion is? He kind of flies in for the match, spends a few days there and goes home again and goes back to Italy again. So he's totally detached, and not that I think he would be swayed by public opinion anyway. But he's been doing it for a long time, and this is the way he wants to play. I don't know if he has massive belief in the ability of the whole team, so he doesn't want people getting above what he thinks are their limitations. So they set them out very rigidly. It's kind of two banks of four, and they keep a clean sheet first and then try and win it.
And he went with Jonathan Walters, didn't he?
He went with Walters, which is a strange one. Walters is one of those that people have been kind of calling out for a long time, that Walters should be involved, and when he wasn't, he got his first competitive start the other day. He kind of played as a battering ram basically up front, and they played a long balls to him, but he did really well. And they've up front is where they have some strength and depth. They have Keane, Doyle, Shane Long, and Walters, and Simon Cox, who he seems to like, and Leon Best, who's doing all right this year for Newcastle. So they've quite. It's a funny. They don't have great talent in the squad, but they have a little bit of depth of a certain standard, and they're difficult to beat. I don't know if they get to the European Championships,
nobody will want to draw Ireland in their group.
No, but anyone who does might well draw with Ireland, because that seems to be their game plan. Any big teams they've played, when they played Italy in the last campaign, they drew with them twice. France in the playoff, they lost one, drew one. Russia this time lost one, drew one. So they don't tend to beat decent teams. But I don't know, we'll see. People are certainly, there's a consistency there. They got to, but for the Henri handball, they could have been in the World Cup, and now they've more or less reached the European Championships. It's not bad for.
Where'd you go after Trapattoni?
Where?
Yeah, I mean, apart from home.
But yeah.
Is there another generation of players coming through? Is the prospects brighter in the future, or are they?
It's kind of hard to say. I mean, there's prospects that you might think could come into the team now, in a couple of individuals, Seamus Coleman, maybe James McCarthy, who are promising players. Ireland tend not to look very long term. Everything is sort of on the hop.
You just pick up a couple of young Scots now.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Even Anton Ferdinand got a mention today, a possible outside contender for the European Championships. So. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think Trapattoni will get a new deal now, and he'll stay on for at least another campaign.
Right,
so
okay.
I think, and he'll stay, I imagine he will stay loyal to the players who've kind of got him here, and he's a very settled team, and he puts a lot of emphasis in the kind of the friendly games and showing up for them and really, being there and not just coming in for qualifiers. And he has a settled team, and he kind of, I think he'll trust them, and we'll see what happens.
Sorry, I'm very puzzled now. Anton Ferdinand?
Yeah.
Right. On what basis?
Well, that's a good question.
It's common knowledge that everybody English has got an Irish grandparent.
Yeah. His middle name is O.
Well, he does. But and Cain Ferdinand, who I think is Anton Ferdinand's cousin, is an Ireland under 21 international.
There you go. So that's some family, isn't it?
We could have the Ferdinand cousins.
Yeah.
On centre-back. I doubt it very much.
We play against each other in that friendly in Dublin.
Sorry?
In the possible friendly in Dublin could be where they go.
And you should have that young Rooney brother who plays for New York Red Bulls as well, and you can just have a whole team doubles.
Yeah. Or you could have Anton against John Terry.
Yes.
Interesting.
What could possibly go wrong? Yeah. And Trapattoni, what we were saying, what the public opinion is of him, but sometimes he does cut a slightly ridiculous figure, generally in press conferences, but there isn't a manager out there, even Sir Alex Ferguson, with a record like his.
Yeah, no, it is incredible. I mean, he said the other night he doesn't speak English very well, and then he said he doesn't speak Italian very well either. So,
but he's done a cracking job, I think. He does a better job of speaking English than Capello does. Do you not think?
Well, I don't know. He's expansive. He's more expansive than Capello, I think.
Right.
But even if you're not quite sure what he's saying, I mean, one of the criticisms has been about his level of English and kind of communication problems with players and misunderstandings and. Some of it's just, I don't know, look, when Kilbane wasn't in the squad for the first time in about 15 years, he seemed to get a text message from a FAI official saying, you know, you're not in the squad, and that was about it. But, you know, at the end, as I said, the end justifies the means and traps the man now.
Yeah, Trapattoni, eh? He's the only manager to have won all UEFA club competitions. Did you know that? He's won the World Club Cup. He's won everything. He's won 10 league titles in 4 different countries.
Did he win the Cup Winners' Cup when that was...
Yeah.
Did he win the Fairs Cup?
I don't know about that one. Was that a UEFA?
That is a UEFA.
When did UEFA again?
But it was under a different name.
I don't know.
As a player, he might have won it.
Did he win the unofficial Fairs Cup?
Yeah, he was also a cracking player. He marked Pele out of the famous thing about Trapp as a player. He marked Pele out of the game.
Does that mean he kicked him out of the game?
Yes.
Yeah.
Like but in a nice way, because Trapp's a very nice man.
Well, kicking was nicer back in the day, wasn't it?
It certainly was.
Not like it is now, all nasty and evil.
You just can't kick anybody anymore.
No.
Of course, you know all about Trapp, because he coached a team that you're not necessarily a fan of, but you follow closely, Bayern Munich. Indeed. Quite successfully the second time around, wasn't it? Or was it the first time that he did well? One of the two didn't go so well.
The second time he won a title and a cup in 2 years.
Well, that's good.
But then they got rid of him because the football was just atrocious.
Right.
He had the best team in Germany playing Pomo.
Right.
Hoof style. It was awful.
Yeah. Well.
He used to say that when the ball is in the other half, it's like the war is on the other side. You know, you don't have to worry about it. So just get the ball. Get the ball up there all the time.
All credit to him. He is. When I first went to Italy, he was, you know, Trapattoni was beyond Sir Alex Ferguson in terms of his stature. He was the man who won everything. And his stock fell considerably. He ended up managing in Switzerland. Cagliari took the job there.
Austria.
Austria, right. But he's managed to kind of reinvent himself. He's a very game old bird.
I think him and Ireland are a perfect match in many ways, especially with Ireland's tradition of playing football at international level. Their style fits very well with what he does.
What might you mean by that, Rafa? Yeah. Perhaps they have a more direct approach.
Right.
Yes.
Now, while the Trapp continues to roll on, has Gus Hiddink lost his mojo for the second set of qualifiers in a row? Looks like he's blown it in the playoffs. Extraordinary result. Croatia went to Turkey. They got a 3-0 win. Ouch. Fans were booing. Looks like the end of the road for Hiddink.
Croatia scored a very early goal as well, which kind of put Turkey on the back foot straight away. And before the match, Hiddink had said that his Turkey side were ready for this and they were going to give it their all. And he seemed very confident. He was talking a lot of bold rhetoric. I just think now for Hiddink... the booing at the end, I mean, he's getting jeered, and they're not going to recover that deficit, that 3-0 deficit. I think he will leave that job, he'll be sacked, and I don't know if his contract was up anyway, in fact, but I wonder if we've seen the last of him in international football now. I mean, there's rumours of him possibly getting an offer to go to PSG and with all the money they've got there. But, I mean, having failed to get Russia to the World Cup and now failed to...
Knocked out in the playoff by Slovenia.
Yeah. And then failed to, you know, to get Turkey to the Euros, it looks very likely. I just wonder whether his stock's fallen, you know, to such a level that maybe only England will be interested next summer.
Well, he's been... certainly let it be known that he's got offers from England and Russia already.
What, the national teams?
Well, he didn't say.
Oh, right. Okay.
Or sources close to him didn't say.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that was part of the problem, that he seemed to be so relaxed and so, you know, I think he said something like, my future's already behind me, and, you know, he couldn't really care too much whether he made it or not personally, on a personal level, that I think it didn't go down well with the public. If you see a manager who obviously doesn't...
Speaking of things that didn't go down well, or actually rather he did, one of my favourite bits in this game you flagged up on your Twitter feed, which is, I understand it's at Honigstein, isn't it? Yeah, there you go. Hamit Altintop's really sensational tumble down near the Croatia end.
It was beautiful.
And yet deeply disturbing.
I struggle to describe it adequately. Yeah. I think you just have to see it in action.
Yeah.
It's such a wonderfully executed tumble.
It is extraordinary.
How
utterly.
Many pipes does he
well,
get?
No, he,
no, it's not that. It's
he just he goes. I mean, he basically goes as though his legs have been scythed away from under him.
There is no player within a 10-meter radius of him.
There's no way he's stumbled either. It's a very, very conscious move. Mm. And it, you know, were there to have been a player next to him, you would have thought. So it's actually a very skillful bit of diving, but utterly Shame.
And I suppose you can only really practice that sort of high-pressure situation in the middle of a match, so it's probably good that he got that dive out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Next time, nailed on.
Next time. So, he wasn't booked or anything for it, was he?
No, he wasn't booked. We should add that the crowd were booing Turkey for the last 30 minutes, and the keeper turned around and was sort of booing back at them and said, yeah, you know, you're great fans.
And it's school of fan negotiation.
Exactly. And it did seem as if there's something very bad happening in Turkey, especially with the trial coming up of all the corruption cases. There's something very, very wrong with Turkish
football. Last season's champions stripped of their title, etc., and a massive... a massive corruption thing there, yeah. It would be strange if that hadn't, to some extent, poisoned the atmosphere. The other playoffs, big result for the Czechs, who beat Montenegro 2-0, although Montenegros say they're not out of that one yet. And, oh dearie me, the game I thought was going to be a sizzler, Bosnia-Herzegovina against Portugal, very much 0-0 as they head back to Portugal for the second leg.
It couldn't be a sizzler because the pitch was beyond... the pale.
Right.
I think Ronaldo called it a potato.
Potato field.
Potato field or something like that. And it was worse than 2 years ago where they played for the World Cup qualifiers. So the Bosnians obviously had been planning this for quite a long time, saying, no, no, do not touch the pitch. We'll need it again. No, it was unbelievable because Ronaldo... probably had the best chance of the game. He was clear one-on-one with the goalkeeper. And just as he was pulling the trigger, you see the ball just take this wicked little bounce. So he shinned it wide. And he was, obviously, he then made a big point of saying, oh, you pitch, you know, pointing to the spot.
Not me.
Yeah, exactly.
Nothing to do with me.
But I think, I mean, it's not a good result, 0-0 away from home in a two-legged tie, but on a proper pitch.
You'd think Portugal are favourites, though, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they are.
One
rogue set piece.
Bosnia played like England. They only had one shot on goal the whole game. They just defended.
Yeah, they do have that. They do have that option going forward. More direct.
They certainly do. Second legs ahoy on Tuesday night. And there's some very interesting games there. Some interesting friendlies as well. I'm particularly excited by Italy-Uruguay. Who wouldn't be? We'll talk more about that, about Germany, about other stuff. Wales, Scotland too, after this. Wales. There we are.
Big mammals.
Big mammals, they certainly are. Yeah. And they can't wait for the World Cup qualifying to get started, can they, Greg?
No, they probably can't. I mean, they were excellent against Norway. They won 4-1. And, I mean, some people would say the performance was much better than Scotland's, who you're all watching behind me I'm trying to speak. I think there were a lot of eyebrows raised when Speed took the job because he'd only managed Sheffield United for 2 months, hadn't done a particularly good job. But he was recently retired from Wales and he was young. He's passionate about his nation and he understood that what Wales needs, which is a country of 3 million where you haven't got many players to choose from, you need to kind of foster a club spirit, a good team mentality, and to have a lot of players coming through at the same time so they can be consistent and grow together. And I think the team that started against Norway had an average age of under 24, and that's including Craig Bellamy as well. So they've got a very bright future together. I mean, they might be confident of doing well in the World Cup qualifiers, but I personally think that Euro 2016 would be a more realistic aim, which would be years after they had qualified for the last major finals as well.
God, is that 40 years?
Well, it would be in 2016 if they were to appear there. But I just think they've got the likes of Ramsey, Ledley, Collison, Bale. They're up like 20, 21, 22, 23 years old. So, I mean, another 4 years'
Joe
time.
Allen.
Yeah, Joe Allen as well at Celtic. I mean, another 4 years'
at
time.
At Swansea.
Yeah, another 4 years' time, they could be 25, 26 years old, all coming into the peak. I think also having Swansea in the Premier League is going to help them because they're going to get more Welsh players coming through and getting a chance to play.
They've also got a Swansea spine to that team as well, with the other Allen and Ashley Williams in the centre-half.
Yeah, and then you've got a current Welsh player.
Steve Morrison up front and then Andrew Crofts in the midfield. But, I mean, what was quite interesting was Sam Vokes getting a couple at the week. He's only still 21. He's a big unit. He's got a bit of technique about him. You know, there's only 3 million population, but And for that, I think it's all the more notable how many good players they've got coming through right now. They do have a strong 11. And you know, but Speed appears to have developed a system that is, one, attractive on the eye, and two, effective with the players he's got.
Mm-hmm.
And the group is, you were about to read the group.
Well, yeah, the World Cup qualifying group. We mentioned this before. Croatia, Serbia, Belgium, Scotland and Macedonia. That, none of them are absolutely top draw, but they're all reasonably quality, or you can imagine them putting up a bit of resistance. But Wales here, that's their fourth win now in five matches.
I think that's the first time they've won three games in a row for about 5 or 6 years or something like that. It's been a long time for them to get to this stage again where they look like they're going to be able to grow into a decent team. I think the one thing, if you had to pick one weakness, it would be the fact that Craig Bellamy's now 32, might not be around much longer. Yeah. And we're talking about other strikers they've got, Sam Vokes, Robson Kanu and Church are very young, and I think they maybe need to have another striker coming through who's perhaps, you know, playing at the top flight, more like Craig Bellamy is.
All right, well, we'll move on to one or two of the other countries. It's a fascinating topic. We'll have to do a whole pod of Wales soon. Badum, Tish. Scotland, whose goals we were just enjoying there in the background. A glorious 2-0 win with goals from Kenny Miller and Jamie Mackey.
It was 2-1, I think.
Oh, was it 2-1?
Yeah, glorious. Glorious 2-1 win.
All right, we didn't have that on our clip. And that was over Cyprus, crucially. There you go. Germany. What happened with the Germans, eh?
Very interesting game. They were 3-3 away to the Ukraine the new stadium in Kiev, which will be used for the Euro final. 5 minutes before kickoff, Löw sprung a surprise on the team and said, "I want you all playing three at the back today." Which didn't work out all that well. They went 3-1 down. He wanted to test the team. He wanted to see if they're adaptable tactically at the drop of a hat. He wanted to make Germany as a team slightly less predictable going into the finals. And also, he said afterwards, "I wanted to test the situation where perhaps during the game we might have to change it and put two strikers up front." The thing is, they didn't really have the right players for that system, because the wing backs, as it were, on that game were really full backs, Augo and Schultz, and they had a lot of width in terms of where they were positioned, but could not do anything with it because they're not the type of players that will go past a man. And then you had three out-and-out centre-backs, so it was all a bit strange. You had Özil and Götze playing together, starting together for the first time. They looked okay-ish, but the whole system did not quite work, and Löw afterwards kind of apologised for it and said, "Look, we wanted to experiment." And it was interesting because all the players were almost kind of joking about it and said, "Yeah, well, of course we can play the system if we practice it a little bit beforehand." Yeah.
So that was 3-0 down they were.
3-1.
3-1 down, and then they came back to tie 3-3.
Yeah, and they probably still should have won it because they had all the chances late on, but they were terribly exposed as well, and they conceded two goals from their own corners. Because the positioning at the back was awful, and Ukraine just hit them with some very good counter-attacking moves.
Is there a possibility or a concern about Götze and Özil playing together, that maybe they might get on each other's toes and stuff?
No, the concern is that they might just be too attacking there in the middle, because the system for a few years now has been a 4-2-3-1, Schweinsteiger plus Khedira, and then one guy, Özil, centrally, or Müller, if Özil is not there. And if you put Götze in there as well, can get a bit lopsided. I think in a game against weak opposition, you can probably do it. You can probably play a 4-1-4-1 that could get Özil and Götze in there in front of a one holding midfielder. And because Schweinsteiger is not there at the moment, he's injured his shoulder, he won't play this year again because Lahm was rested. They did experiment a bit. Now, interesting enough, they're playing Holland on Tuesday, which is not the sort of game you want to experiment too much.
4-1-4-1 on, no.
Holland could really destroy them if they wanted to, and it will have a bit of a needle.
Yeah.
I mean, going forward, Holland are wonderful, even without...
Van der Vaart's injured, isn't he? Yeah.
Yeah, Van Persie and Van der Vaart unfortunately won't play. Huntelaar is playing, but with a broken nose, very much in the Czech mold. It's a new trend now, these masks. Balak has one at the moment as well.
Oh, yeah. And will Götze play?
Götze might play, yes.
Because no Götze, no glory.
yeah, but it's in Hamburg, right. So that's where Holland beat Germany in the Euro 1988 finals on the way to their triumph. And it does have that bit of extra
sizzle
meaning to it, because it is Germany-Holland.
Yep.
So it'd be a very, very interesting game.
All right.
Probably the most, I would confidently say, or reasonably confident say, it'll be the most interesting game on Tuesday night.
If you watch one game on Tuesday, that's the one to watch.
Unfortunately, you won't be able to watch it, I think, in the UK.
Is it not? No. Is there,
unless you come round to mine.
Oh, there you go.
It will be on.
All round to Rafa's.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you'll be doing some of that nice Osobuco, will you? Yeah. No,
yes,
all right. Because if you didn't want to watch that, I don't know if you can. Can you watch Italy Uruguay on UK TV?
I wonder if the internet exists. Does the internet exist?
That's true. Mario Balotelli's now become the man there, because, you know, the rest are all. I was going to say crook, but it probably has the wrong connotations with, given the nation we're talking about. Anyway, and but they had a 2-0 win over Poland. A fantastic goal from Balotelli. Well, pretty good anyway. And Pazzini also scored, so that's working up front. They're very happy about that. They are playing next Uruguay.
And, you know, we all know that Luis Suarez can't finish.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, he's been awful for Liverpool this season. He's
four
finishing,
goals.
Yeah.
Four goals. How many did he miss, though?
Against Norwich.
Oh, against Norwich. How
no,
many
no,
did
he
miss?
Had... For
Uruguay, I mean, the chances he had were... They were fantastic. I mean, the first one was from like 25 yards out on his left foot, and he just banged it straight into the bottom right hand corner, a bit like Robbie Fowler used to do it in his heyday. That kind of just arrowed it in. And I mean, a lot of people have criticised Suarez for not being able to maybe put his chances away this year, but I think that's because he has to wriggle his way through for Liverpool half the time, and when he gets through, he's off balance. But for Uruguay, the chances he had, they were just clean strikes, and a header as well on
goal. A couple of headers, wasn't it?
And one with his right shoulder. So I mean, it was left foot, right foot, header, perfect hat trick plus a left shoulder. So it's better
Brilliant.
Than a perfect hat trick.
So 4-0, Uruguay beat Chile, the much acclaimed Chile, and he got all four goals. That's going to be a sizzling game then, I reckon. You got Cavani as well for. Uruguay as well. One or two other players.
Is Forlan retired now?
No, he's out injured, isn't he?
Yeah, he's injured at the moment, yeah.
Out injured.
How's Cassano doing, by the way, speaking of injuries?
Well, he's had his operation and...
Recuperating.
Well, recuperating, yeah, but at least 6 months, they say. So, yeah. Do you know, I think that brings us to the end of today's Football Weekly experience. Yes, Rafa, I know, I'm sorry, but... That's all we've got time for. You'll come back, though, another time, I hope.
If you'll have me.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Greg, thank you for being with us today.
Cheers.
And Paul McGuinness as well. And producer Ben, who's back. And you, the listener, will be back on Thursday with a reaction to Tuesday's games and a big look forward to club action. See you then.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.